to Find Tell Share, the Storytellers podcast. Here we interview entrepreneurs and artists who share their stories as we discuss everything storytelling. I'm Gemma Rosenthal.
And I'm Chris Sissons. And on today's show, we're going to explore uncharted paths, story archaeology with Stephen King, yes, that one, and how stories benefit mental health.
And this time, we're delighted to introduce our guest, Tanya LeGault. Tanya is a passionate professional who questions the box, thinks outside of it, then builds a better one. She achieves this novelty by breaking stereotypes and paving uncharted paths with clearer communications. In fact, pioneering is instinctive to her, as she believes nothing extraordinary was ever achieved by being ordinary. Thus, Tanya loves connecting with people, empowering them with tools to accomplish their goals, and ultimately adding value to their life, be it personal or professional. Tanya says, "Seeing a person or business perform its full potential brings me great joy and gives me the impression that I'm making a difference. So that is how I make an impact on the world." Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you so much, Gemma.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
It is my pleasure to join in from across the pond.
Yes, you're joining us from Canada. Is that correct?
Exactly, East Coast to be precise.
Okay, so you're actually the second Canadian that we've had on the podcast. Episode 19 as well, we had Debbie Bridge, although she lives in London. But you're actually there, so it's really exciting. Can you tell us a little bit more about what it means to you? I'm interested in this questioning the box, thinking outside the box. What does that mean to you?
So that's a great question, Gemma. For me, questioning the box is, you know, in marketing or in creative spaces, you're often asked, hey, think outside the box. Let's kind of reinvent the wheel, bring something fresh. For me, I studied business, and so this was a common approach. However, I felt that we could use that approach outside of the business world. So when I say I question the box, it's sometimes it could be for a recipe. That's a great example, because I tend to create food in the scope of colors. So I'll follow a recipe, and let's say you're making a carrot type of soup. Well, I'll think of other ingredients that I could add to this soup that might be a little unconventional, but still linked to it. So it's not because it's a carrot soup that I couldn't put in. I always love to mix ingredients that are the same color. So maybe I'd want to add in an orange to give it a little bit of acidity, but a little bit of sweetness. Now, this is a very trivial example. No one is being revolutionized by adding oranges to a carrot soup, but the approach is applicable to other realms of our life, because in terms of a recipe or making food, you had a certain instructions, certain guidelines to follow, and you threw in that little bit of novelty and that spice. And as a result, it creates excitement. And so that's pretty much for me what questioning the box means, and then creating a new one, because you take what exists, but then you add your flavor to it, and you also see, is it pertinent to me? I'll come right back to the recipe just to drive this point home. But in a recipe, sometimes they'll suggest or advise certain spices, and you might not like those spices in particular. Now, would you discard the recipe completely, or would you simply amend those spices and maybe take something you truly appreciate? So that's a, again, very simple application of questioning the box, but I think it makes the concept a lot more relatable for individuals. So there you have it, Gemma.
Oh, thank you. Do you have any specific recipes that are typical to Canada, like that you would be able to share, or is it similar to what we eat here?
Well, there's given that I'm from the East Coast and the French Canadian province of Canada, there is the infamous poutine, which are the French fries with the kind of dollops of cheese or cheese curds, pardon me, with the gravy. And then you can add some toppings. And I had to precise French fries because I know for us here, fries would be the equivalent of crisps for the UK. So I just want to get that cleared away.
Like chips.
So poutine is chips with cheese and gravy, yeah. Basically.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Okay. But
fries is normally what you would call fries, I think. And then chips. Yeah, chips would be, no, crisps.
Chips are crisps. There. And fries are chip.
I don't know.
That's it. Yeah, fries are chips, and chips for us would be your crisps.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. So that would be a very local type of food. Another one that is, I would say international, but the names do change from place to place. And I think the texture of this food varies as well. So we have in the Montreal area, the smoked meat. Now in the United States, they call that corned beef. And then in, let's say, the Italian culture, that might be considered pastrami. So that could be another food that could be more associated to our area. And smoked meat, you can eat it by itself, but usually it's served in a sandwich made with rye bread and just topped with a little
That's
bit of
pastrami and rye, which is a famous sandwich that I've never encountered and wouldn't know what to do with if I did, as I'm a vegetarian. Corned beef, I haven't seen corned beef for years. It used to come in rectangular tins, and there was a key, and you sort of had to thread. There was a little metal end, and you had to thread it onto the key, and then you turned the key, and a ribbon of metal round the top, and then you pulled the top off, and then somehow you had to still get the meat out of the can, which was, I mean, my father just got a tin opener and opened the other end, and then you could push it through.
Oh, brother! Yes, okay.
But that was cool. Do you remember that, Gemma? I've not looked at corned beef for years, so I don't know if they still do it that way.
So yeah, thank you for sharing about that. I think we were talking about food on that episode as well. Episode 19, was that the topic on that?
That was a Christmas topic, wasn't it? Yeah,
and that was with Debbie, who's Canadian as well. But it just so happens, I don't know why we're talking about food again, but it happens. But then. Yeah, so we obviously on this podcast we're interested in the storytelling of how you can use different things like for example with food. It's a really useful kind of tool to describe, you know, how things taste, how things look, how it smells, and all those different things that you'd say when you're telling a story. So I know you're going to be sharing a little bit about your business today. Is that correct in your story?
Exactly correct, Gemma.
So could you tell us, just before you tell your story, just a little brief, a briefing about your business and what it is that you do?
Certainly. So my organization is called Top Tier Consulting, and the whole premise of Top Tier, I'll give the explanation of the name, which is unrelated to it's related to the story, but it won't spoil the story. And so the premise of Top Tier is we can look at the Olympics and the podium. you have three positions on the podium, but there is still a hierarchy. So although you might get on the podium, perhaps you get the bronze medal. So you have a way to improve and obtain the silver medal or the gold medal. And that, to me, is top tier, because you can be on the podium as an individual or as an organization, but there is still room for improvement on that podium if you come in at the bronze level or if you are currently at gold. Because even if you come in at gold, well, you want to stay there and want to remain that best self. And so top tier consulting is that promotion, that strive for excellence. It's not a strive for perfection, because that would be unattainable, but excellence in an individual, excellence in an organization. And the services offered are resources in order to tap into that excellence, exploit that potential that an individual or an organization might have. And so we will get into the services in a nutshell. There's mentorship, again, to an individual or to an organization. There is also wealth management, more tailored to the individuals, because oftentimes money is a huge topic in individuals' lives. And for the businesses, I like to focus on team building, because there might be an existing team that, given that it's comprised of individuals, they each have their situation to address. So you want to support them in that endeavor. And also, perhaps the team has to grow. It's very small right now, but the vision for the organization is tremendous. And so you have to attract that great talent, integrate them into the existing team that's in place, even if that's two or three people. And so this is what the organization is centered around. These are the products, well, more the services rather, offered to the public. And I just want to precise that even though I am based out of Canada, it doesn't matter where the individuals or the organizations are located, because thankfully with the internet, virtual collaboration is possible. And as long as individuals speak French or English, there'll be comprehension there. So there you have it.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing. Could you just coming from, because when I did a coaching qualification a few years ago, so I do coaching, and one of the things we had to talk about as part of the course was writing the difference between consulting, mentoring, and coaching. So I'd just like to hear in your own words what, I don't know if you know anything about coaching, but how is consulting different from a coach, for example, or a well, you said you did mentoring as well, so how does it differ? How is it the same?
That's a great question. For me, consulting is more of a business term. So consulting, I see that type of insight as strategic, as a advisor, and it's structured in order to achieve goals. And again, this is my definition. So a consultant, I wouldn't apply that to an individual's life, because, and this could also be a North American term. In North America, people from outside an organization who come in and offer assistance are considered consultants, because there is a certain level of expertise that gets associated to that position, and a certain amount of respect, in the sense that, well, we're coming here to help, and we know that it might be a little painful for some time because we'll encounter changes, but after that we will be improved, and it's a short-term pain for long-term gain. Now, if we compare that to a coach, that I associate more to the individual contribution or collaboration. Again, we're very familiar with coaches in the sports world, where you are being leveled up in order to improve your performance. And also with time, the coaching has come out of sports and into nutrition, but that was tied nevertheless to sports, because how your physical well-being is often related to what you ingest first and foremost. But then the coaching world started getting into mindset coaching, and then it started in getting into your life coach. And so I felt that the coach is that mentor that you'll select in order to help you with a precise area in your life as an individual. And so that brings us to the mentorship. The mentorship for me is that wise individual who you might go to everything and anything. You know, they're like that very sage parent or grandparent. When I think of mentor, I'm thinking of growth, not so much of stretching your performance or improving it necessarily, just overall awareness, consciousness. So it's a little more maybe spiritual or maybe more personal, because a mentor will help you connect with you, help you get to know you, and offer that objective insight that raises your consciousness of the world or certain actions. So that's how I define each of the three terms we mentioned, Gemma: coach, consultant, and mentor.
Thank you. Chris, do you have any thoughts on that? How you describe those things? Or
I don't disagree with any of it, any of what Tanya said, because I think the terminology tends to be fairly, it varies from place to place. I mean, I use two terms in my own head. One is expert consultancy, which is where the consultant is an expert in whatever the consultancy is about. So a website designer, for example, would be an expert consultant. And then there's a non-directive consultant. And the difference there is that the consultor, that's the person who's working with the consultant, is the expert. And when I started talking about that, everybody said, "That's coaching." So when I use coaching, I usually mean non-directive consultancy.
Yeah,
basically, a non-directive consultant, they're an expert in coaching or non-directive consultancy. But there's a big advantage in not being an expert in the thing that the consultor is an expert in, because you're not bringing your prejudices to the conversation. You can control your prejudices if you do have some, but yeah, it does mean you can listen and approach the consultancy in that listening mode. And I find with a lot of business owners, they're not brilliant listeners. They've got this thing that they're passionate about, and that's all they want to talk about. But when you get into a conversation with a prospect, they're not really interested in what you're an expert in. They're interested in a problem that they have. And that's what needs to be talked about. But we all need both expert consultancy and non-directed consultancy skills, really, whatever we're doing, I suspect, to varying degrees. Anyway.
So true.
Okay. So Tanya, off you go with your story.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much. So I'll come back to my childhood a little bit to give some weight, I guess, to the story. So I grew up spending a lot of time with my grandfather, and he owned his own business. He was a solopreneur at the time. You know, these terms didn't exist, but today we have the great knowledge of these new terms that have emerged. So he had a business, worked for himself, and serviced some clients. And spending time with him as a child, you know, you're kind of their helper of get them the paper here and package this and do that. And so I got a lot of love and appreciation for the business world. Although it was a male-dominated industry, given that it was in the mechanics and automobile upkeep and maintenance space, I still had a lot of respect pointed towards me, and people were very welcoming. So I associated great things to the business world. So, understandably, in school, I chose to pursue a business degree. And so I, having such great feelings about the business world, I thought, well, I want to be around the people again. And so I chose to specialize in human resources. And upon graduating with that business degree with the human resources specialty, I worked in that industry and worked as a manager for some time. And so, again, I applied that HR knowledge. What are people like? How do they react? What do they want? A little bit like Chris was mentioning with what's a person's problem and how can we solve it? And so with the pandemic, again, many of our world changed. And I noticed that many companies hadn't changed their approach to doing business. So what do I mean by that? I'll take marketing campaigns. In Canada, again, I'll speak for my area because I don't know about everyone's. Many companies were recycling their material. So, for example, people were being invited to come with their families to celebrate when there was a certain curfew and lockdown taking place. So it appeared to me that there was a lack of sensitivity or consideration for the current conditions that we were experiencing. And I thought, wow, how unfortunate that these companies are leaving money on the table, because I'll take myself. Upon hearing that type of marketing, I was not incited or enticed, rather, to visit that company or to purchase its services or products. On the contrary, it had me kind of shy away from that business. So it was kind of bad publicity on their end. And so I thought, wow, that's really too bad that unconsciously they were hurting their business, because no one markets something to the intent of hurting their enterprise, right? And so I just made a mental note of that, because these were uncertain times. I wasn't in the mind space yet to make a business out of it. And then some time passes and we move into the Great Resignation, where people have had time to think and they're connecting with what they truly want. And they wake up to say, hey, my life is not how I would dream it to be. Let's make some changes. And so, again, in North America, many individuals were leaving their jobs, creating a lot of vacancies, and companies were now faced with, I have a need to fill, I have staff to hire, what shall I do? And so, being from that HR world, I got curious about this topic. And I did a research on a certain employees that had featured on less than favorable employer lists. And I discovered that many of them didn't even have a career page. So if they were truly looking for people, there was no way to find the vacancies that they needed to fill. And for other companies, you could find the career page, yet unfortunately, you had no idea what they offered their prospective employees and what it was like to work at that organization. So once again, I had this thought to say, it's unfortunate that no one is stepping up and verbalizing this dichotomy, because you have a need, you have vacancies to fill, but the dichotomy is you're not advertising explicitly these vacancies, and you're not doing anything to attract the people who are looking for work towards your organization. So now at this point, I had two needs that I was noticing in the market that could be fulfilled with the insight I had acquired from my experience as well as my education. And that's how I came to create Top Tier. So initially, it was more geared towards the organizations, but through speaking with individuals, be it business people or just regular people, individuals, I came to expand the services to what I mentioned previously. And so now servicing organizations, companies, and individuals. But that's the story of how I came to be Top Tier Consulting.
Thank you, Tanya. Thank you for sharing your story. And I love how you're passionate about, you know, helping people and seeing how the businesses were perhaps hindering that service because of the way they were marketing it. And sometimes we don't always know that we're hindering what we're doing, and it's just having someone to help with that can really, really help. Like Chris works with businesses on storytelling, and sometimes they don't realize that they have this story that can support with their business, and then just having someone tell them that can help.
Absolutely. I think it comes down to objectivity. You know, for the type of work Chris does, a lot of organizations are so accustomed to their own story that they take it for granted. They don't realize the value that is embedded in them, because that's what they've known their whole life or the whole existence of that company. And it's the same with the as you mentioned, Gemma, you know, that they're hurting themselves is, let's be honest, during the times that we have passed, a lot of organizations went into survival mode and desperation. And we all know that in that frame of mind, we don't think as clearly as we would when there was no threat to the longevity or the performance of our company. And so again, that's why I emphasize the human aspect and the empathetic standpoint, because it's not a question of judging or pointing the finger. It really is a fostering of assistance and help and guide. However, someone has to speak up in order to pinpoint that either that dichotomy or that small element that's missing. It's not a lack so much. It's maybe just not knowing, as you mentioned, Gemma. And you can be upset at someone for not knowing what they don't know. That's the whole point of growth throughout our life. So I really appreciate how you brought that point home, Gemma. Thank you.
Yeah, I do find that stories are wonderful disruptive elements. And I mean, Gemma's heard me say this many times. I've probably said it on the podcast many times, that I think it's true of all business owners that no one fully understands their business. It's in their heads somewhere. Getting it out and making the connections that are actually going to take the business forward is really difficult. And stories are often misbehave. They don't do what we want them to. If you're trying to hammer a story into some point on your sales funnel, it'll sometimes bounce back and hit you between the eyes, and you think, "Oh, hang on a minute! This is not saying that at all. It's saying something completely different, which I hadn't realised before." Yes, because we're actually dealing with our subconscious, and learning to listen to the subconscious that sees the world in quite a different way to how we consciously see the world. Just learning how to hear that. And our storytelling is a great way of doing it. I mean, you're never gonna find those hidden connections by looking at a computer screen, whatever's on it.
Well, I know that you're going to tell us something about story archaeology.
Right, I shall do that. Yes, yeah, I want to recommend to our listeners the beer link in the show notes, a book by Stephen King, which is called On Writing. Now, some of you might be familiar with Stephen King. He's written over 200 books, apparently, most of them novels. He's only written two non-fiction books. On Writing is one of them, and the other one is some sort of history of horror as a genre. So it could be called On Writing Fiction, because that's what he does. And clearly he does it really well. I mean, I must say, I'm not a great horror fan. I don't know about you two. Gemma's not.
Neither am I.
I mean, I've heard some of his books serialized on the radio, and they were terrifying enough. But he clearly is a very good storyteller, because people buy his books. And basically what he says is, no writing course, no book on writing is going to teach you how to write. The only way to learn how to write is, I'm sure you could chorus this with me, to write. yeah, that is it. But he then goes on, but there's quite a few insights. He talks about the circumstances, you know, how you might set up your life so that you actually do so many words a day, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, just the basic discipline of creating the space in which you can write. But it then gets on to the question, if you're writing a novel, should you plan it? And a lot of people plan their novels, and I'm sure you could find authors who do that. But Stephen King has never done that. He never has a plan. What he does is he starts with a situation. For example, mother and small child, cars run out of petrol, stuck in the car, doors locked with a rabid dog outside. That's a book called Cujo. And how do they get out? I don't know how they get out, but he says, you know, he didn't know, once he had that situation, he didn't know how they were going to get out of it. And it's for them to work it out, the child and the mother. So his characters work out the solutions to the problems that he... And he says it's like... this is where the archaeology comes in. It's like unearthing, say, a skeleton. You know, you find a bone, maybe a femur or something, and you dig very carefully around it and use brushes, and gradually you've discovered that the femur is actually close by other bones, and you've got a whole skeleton, and you can bring the whole thing out and find out what animal it is, and what period it was from, and what it was doing when it died. Or if it was a human skeleton, it may have been part of a burial, and it's been buried with objects and things like that, which you'd also unearth. And so the story begins as just a little bit poking out of the soil, and then gradually he unearths the whole story. And out of that, if you're going to get really advanced, you can begin to find maybe there's a theme in the story that he didn't see before he started telling the story, or maybe there's symbolism. So when he does his revision of the story, he can strengthen those elements and make them clearer. The first thought I had was, when I read that, it's the same for non-fiction stories. I've been working with people, I've done around about 80 meetings in public places or Zoom with people who are telling a business story. And it's just, it's often, not always, but often it's very similar. You start digging around the story, and something emerges that completely transforms the story. Now, as I said before, stories don't behave. You know, they never do what you want them to do. I haven't heard Tanya's story until just now, but I thought it might be worth doing a little bit of digging around the story, see what we can find. And Gemma, do you know, join in if something strikes you. I think the only thing I want to say, Tanya, is if there's anything that you don't want to share, don't share it. That's fine. We're looking for material that you can use. So if you can't use it, there's no point in bringing it up. So what I want to ask you about is, how old were you when you started working with your grandfather?
I would say 9 years old. No. And the reason was, in Canada, you know, the school year finishes around June and you start back end of August. And most children, if their parents work, they'll go to day camp. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't appreciate day camp because they had us run around and do all of these physically arduous things when it was super hot outside. And I'm thinking, why can't we sit in the shade and, you know, play some games that children play? But why do I have to start running in the beaming sun? So I told my mother, I said, hey, Grandpa here works from home majority of the time, because repairing these vehicles, I mean, you're outside and you've got the garage. So I said, can I go with him? And that's when it started, around 9 till 12, that I'd spend my summers with him.
Okay. So can you describe him a bit? I mean, how old roughly was he, and what did he look like? And anything you...
Excellent. Well, let me do the math here. I would say he was probably in his mid-50s when we were... or maybe late 50s. And he was quite a tall gentleman. I think he did like 6 feet. And he was of European descent, but born in Canada. So his parents were immigrants, but he was a Canadian citizen. He had, I felt he had like a darker skin tone, maybe that olive type of skin tone, and had very dark black hair. Like jet black was a feature you can recognize of him. And he had this love for Johnny Cash. So he really did dress in black with the jeans and, you know, that dress shirt. When he would go out, that was his attire. And so it's funny how, you know, some men, they'll put a suit and tie and that's how they dress up, with really polished shoes. My grandfather, if we were to go to an outing, his representation of dressing up, considering he was a mechanic and maintenance worker for most of the week, he would put his cowboy boots, but that looked super pristine. He'd wear his Levi's jeans, because in his mind there was no other type. And then he would not cut the seam, the legs of the jeans. He would roll them up, so cuff them, in order for them to be the right length for him. He'd have the beautiful buckle on those jeans, and he'd wear his black shirt. And then, if it was, you know, colder times in Canada, he'd wear his leather jacket. Mm-hmm. I think you could tell from that attire, sure, the respect he had.
Did you ever go out with him dressed, when he was dressed like that? You know,
we'd go to the restaurant, indeed, yeah. Or, you know, if there were some school events or ceremonies, I remember him sitting in the audience in that attire.
Mm-hmm. I just have this sort of image of this sort of big, tall cowboy person and a little scruffy 9-year-old girl. If she wasn't scruffy, what was she?
I was definitely a very tall young girl.
All right.
So I think
not quite so little. Yeah.
Not so much, but I mean, there's a kind of a joke that goes around my family where people say, oh yes, when Tanya was 2 years old, and they put their hand up about 4 feet high. I mean, I wasn't that tall when I was two, but being a tall lady myself, that's kind of why I was able to run around with my grandfather, because I could pass for a couple years older than I truly was. And given that I was an only child, I knew that not to speak too much and more listen.
So how did you get on with him before you started working with him?
Oh, very well. Because given that I was his only grandchild, well, not that he had no choice but to appreciate me, but, you know, he was stuck with me. He didn't have other grandkids.
Well, you know what I'm going to ask you? When, I'm not sure whether it was you or your mother asked him if you could work with him, what did he say?
Oh, he was delighted because, you know, when I say that he had no other grandchildren, he chose the side of appreciating his grandfather role. And he thought, hey, it doesn't matter that she's a girl and I'm a man. I will introduce her to cars and share my passion with her, and she'll do what she wants with it.
So where did he work? Was that a garage or a...
It was on his own property. So it was a garage. Mm-hmm. However, it was on a private property. So nothing commercial on a big street or highway.
He wasn't worried about letting you loose under cars with drills. And...
I didn't have hands on mechanical work. But sometimes, you know, those... gosh, how do you call them? They're kind of beds that you roll under the vehicle. If he wasn't using those, I might use that as a skateboard, or if I was in the grass, kind of use it, sit on it and use my hands to move myself forward as if it was a wagon. So, I mean, I stayed in that world, but made it my own. And that could come back, Gemma, to, you know, kind of questioning the box. Yes, this is a bed to lie under a car, but why can't I use it as a skateboard? Who said it wasn't possible? So that's another example of how you kind of break the barriers of maybe society or just culture that has... put on us. But again, it's not anything limiting.
Okay, I've got my eye on time, but there's a very important question that I want to ask you. If you could stay in that world, but what would you see as the... I mean, you included this aspect of your childhood in the story of the creation of Top Tier. How would you describe what is it that you took away from that experience with your grandfather that you now apply in Top Tier?
It would probably be the type of work he did, because if you look at maintenance, what do? You take what is existing and you bring it back to its optimum performance. So you make the best of what you have in front of you. He used to build like automotive trailers as well. And so when you build all of that, you're building it like brand new. So what can be the best? How can it be most efficient? And that's exactly the types of questions I ask myself when working with individuals or organization is, okay, if you have a certain goal and you're not there yet, how can we make those small modifications to bring you back to optimal performance?
Obviously, we're a little bit rushed here, but I think that there is something there in that you've got this lovely relationship between you and your grandfather. And in a way, in a sense, that relationship... I mean, is he still alive or...?
He passed, unfortunately.
Right, but you can, but that relationship is also present in your work today, and finding that link is could be really helpful. I mean, the thing is, I mean, there's a lot of detail, and you won't always be able to share all the detail, but that relationship is compelling to an audience. And if you can engage them with that relationship, and grandfather, granddaughter, or grandparent, grandchild relationships are always moving. And if you can enchant the audience with that, you can then take them with you when you go on to talk about top tier. Needs a bit more work on it. You can see where I'm going with this.
Absolutely. And it's a beautiful visual on top of that.
Now, I'm wondering, Gemma, a sort of question for you to lead into your section. Tanya described maintenance as getting presumably a car, automobile, from being a bit out of whack into becoming like new. Is this what working on mental health is like, or is it something completely different from that?
That's a really interesting question. I'm going to just see what my answer is, because I don't actually know. I'm just going to see what comes out of my mouth and see if it's true or not. So just questioning, pondering with that question, because I've never been asked it before. I think there is an element of maintenance. Okay, I do know how to answer this question. So in the therapy that I did, DBT, which is called dialectical behavioral therapy, there's two different aspects of, well, I think there's three different aspects, but the way that we look after our mental health using this framework is there's what you do when you're in a crisis, and then there's what you do to prevent crisis. So I don't know which one maintenance comes into. I suppose it would be preventing a crisis. But so, for example, if you're already wound up or in an anxious state or depressed, you're not likely going to be able to sort of do the regular things that you need to do. So it might be that in that moment, you just need to perhaps, I don't know, put on a comedy or put on a film that you like to watch that's going to make you feel better. You know, that could even be a sad film if you want to cry out the emotions or anything. But if you, depending on how you're feeling, whether it's, you know, if you're really, really sad, I probably wouldn't recommend watching a sad film. But but if you're anxious, maybe watching a sad film could kind of calm you down, because it would get you into your emotions. So, for example, this morning, I actually was quite anxious. And then I didn't really know what to do. My brain wasn't able to function of thinking about the tasks of the day yet. It got onto that later, but I actually turned on the TV and it was actually the news, and they were interviewing people in Sunderland about the cost of living crisis, which is happening here. I don't know what the situation is over there in Canada, but and I actually ended up in tears over some of the people that they were interviewing were just regular folk, people that couldn't afford, you know, the cost of living and different aspects of their life, food. And they were so emotional, as in they were so just everything was on the table. Some of the people, not all of them, but that I actually ended up in tears. And I'm saying this is a good thing for my mental health, not because it's a good thing what they were going through, but it took me out of my own problems and into empathy, which I think we were talking about before. And that ability to actually empathize with other people is very important to mental well-being. And I don't know if you'd call that maintenance as such. It's not like fixing a car, but it's about fixing your mindset so that you're focusing differently. So I've also been looking studying the Enneagram a lot, which is a personality. I don't know what you'd call it. Chris introduced me to it. It's a system based on personalities, different 9 personalities. And one of the things which I've really learned is that every personality needs a different, is going to need something different for their mental health and well-being. So for example, 2s are very helpful people, so they're always putting their focus outward. So for a 2, it might not work to then say to them, you need to focus more on other people, because they're always focusing on other people. So they need to focus more on themselves and think, well, what do I need, and how can I, you know, work on my well-being? Whereas for me, I think I'm a 4, as I had a coaching session with an Enneagram coach. And if I am a 4, then I need to focus more on practical things and getting things done, which moves me to a 1, which they're focused on goodness and making the world right and justice and things like that. And also focusing on other people, which can be helpful as well. So I don't know whether we should put some links to people so they can understand these things, but what I'm speaking about, because I know they're 2 different types of therapy or self-development. Back to answering your question, is it about maintenance or is it something else? I think it is and it isn't. I think it's about, yeah, you do have to do maintenance, but it's also about letting go of maintenance, if that makes sense. Because sometimes if we get too caught up in, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do the other, that can be detrimental to mental health as well. Sometimes we just have to let go and have fun and relax. So it depends on what side of the scale you are, if that makes any sense. Again, if you're a, depending on your type, personality type, if you are always sort of maintaining life, then that might be a thing of, okay, I've got to relax now. Or if you're very relaxed, then you might have to maintain a bit. Is this making sense?
Absolutely.
Yes. When my mother died, my father was left on his own, and he outlived my mother for 15 years, so he was on his own for a very long time. But from day one, he was absolutely adamant he was going to set the table. Yeah, he would cook a meal and he would sit at the table and he would eat the meal. He was on his own, and he was actually disciplined all the way through the day, and it gave his life structure. So in that sense, I think maintenance sort of makes sense, but I do suspect there's more to it than just maintenance.
Well, I think it's about self-kindness, which and kindness towards other people as well. So developing compassion and intimacy with yourself and others, it kind of goes beyond maintenance. So maintenance is helpful but only if the goal is towards, so the maintenance helps you live more compassionately, if that makes sense. I was actually working with someone last night on this particular topic, and she was saying how she couldn't get herself to do the routine that she wanted to do, you know, and it's like, it's reframing. So as a coach, we work on reframing. Well, how can we make it more interesting for you to actually, so you do it? And part of it is saying, well, if I do it, then that's being kind to myself. You know, when I put in that structure, that helps me feel better. If I go for a walk, if I go for a run, if I, you know, eat well, it's all about looking after yourself.
I think I've quoted many times before the Zen, I chopped wood, I drew water, and then I attained enlightenment, and now I chop wood and I draw water.
Yeah.
I think it's something I found as I've got older, that the routine is actually a positive. Yeah. Mm. It's what keeps me going. And yeah, it's looking after myself, but it's also the great thing about routine is you always know what you're going to do next.
It's good not to know sometimes, though. I think that mystery, being in the mystery, being in the unknown, and being comfortable with that, and being spontaneous as well. A lot of us need that.
Well, that's where a lot of stories begin, though, isn't it? You know, Bilbo Baggins set out with, what was it, 10 dwarves and a wizard, and he left his pocket handkerchief at home. And he goes all over the world doing all sorts of things. He eventually gets home and presumably reunited with his pocket handkerchief. There's something about the interesting and exciting things become easy to take into your stride.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Tanya?
I totally agree that, sometimes that structure... It can offer that that mental relaxation. But to your point, Gemma, the structure doesn't have to be like a timetable. It can be today I choose to do nothing, or today I am doing something for me. I don't know what that is yet, but I will let inspiration guide me, or the day, the weather, what have you, and I'll just dedicate all this time for me. On the contrary, if someone has been very left to themselves for a while, structure, for example, a schedule, might give them a lot of enjoyment. Because if I come back to like the striving for excellence, you might gain a lot of productivity for that. It might boost your self-esteem, your confidence. It might have you wrap up things you procrastinated to do for so much time. So you sometimes in coaching, you probably tell your clients this, Gemma, it's a victory over the past. I've never done that before, but you did today. And so I just love how all these small elements can truly help the mental health. And to your point, maintenance might not be explicit in everything that we're doing. So for some people, getting that awareness that Chris was mentioning, it might be an intense, deep emotional period. And after that, they're just upkeeping. Everyone's journey is different, and the life experiences that you encounter will also play into your mental health journey. So that's what I would add to the topic.
Thank you, Tanya. Okay, so we're near the end of the podcast now. So if you'd like to share how we can get in touch with you, if anyone is interested in consulting, we're going to put the links on there anyway, but if you can just share a bit about that.
Of course. So I invite everyone who's listening to reach out to me on LinkedIn. It's always pleasant to put a face to the invisible listeners that we are reaching today. I also like it when people reach out to me on LinkedIn and give me a little intro as to who they are, because you might hear me today, but I can't see you hearing me. So I'd love to know how you came to know of me. The other thing is, on the website, I do detail the services, what I offer, and there is the possibility to book a meeting. It's completely free. There is no charge, and I would love to just to get to know you. So the whole point is connection, whether that's on LinkedIn or on a one-to-one private meeting, no problem at all. And given that the links will be provided, people can reach out and connect.
Thank you. And Chris?
Yeah, the main thing that I do is telling stories, making business. And you've got two options. If you live in Sheffield or near Sheffield, you can be our storyteller or come along and take part as a participant and listen to a business owner tell their story over lunch And we've had some really good meetings this autumn over a sandwich, exploring other people's stories. And if you don't live in Sheffield, if you live in, I don't know, take random places, Canada or the United States or France or whatever, then we can also do telling stories on Zoom. And we do that at 2 o'clock in the afternoon without sandwiches. I'm afraid you lose the sandwiches if you don't live near Sheffield. But it's a great opportunity to listen to a business owner's story and then work on it. And we usually have about 30 to 45 minutes to discuss the story and work out how it might be used to promote that business owner's business. But the purpose is to help the participants improve their storytelling. The storyteller takes a lot away because obviously they get a colossal amount of feedback, but providing feedback itself is really, really important if you're going to take storytelling seriously as part of your marketing.
Thank you, Chris. And if you would like to get in touch with me, that is creativehearts.coach on Facebook, Instagram, and then I'm on LinkedIn as Gemma Rosenthal, Twitter Gemma Rosenthal, Facebook and Instagram also Gemma Rosenthal, and YouTube as well for Gemma Rosenthal and Creative Hearts. And coming up in the next few months, I will be doing quite a few workshops with people who are co-authors of Words of the Wise, which we have a podcast already with Jennifer McKenzie. That is episode
26.
Yes. And so I will be doing some workshops with the co-authors of Words of the Wise, and we'll also be doing some Facebook Lives. So if you just check out Creative Hearts on Facebook, all the details will be on there. And yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Farewell.